You're listening to ESL Podcast English Cafe, number
553.
This is English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, episode 553. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Visit ESLPOD.com. and become a member of ESL Podcast so that you can download our learning guide for this episode. Our learning guide contains a complete transcript of everything I say, along with a complete list of the vocabulary terms, definitions, sample sentences, and a cultural note. On this cafe, we're going to talk about an American writer, politician, and military leader whom few Americans have heard of despite his importance to our history, a man by the name of Lew Wallace. We're also going to talk about a 1970s television show that almost every American has heard of, The Brady Bunch. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions too. Today we talk about a very interesting American whose name most Americans nowadays would not recognize, even though he was one of the most well-known writers of the late 19th century and wrote the best-selling book of his generation, Lewis Wallace. Lewis Wallace was born in April of 1827 in the state of Indiana, which is located in the north-central part of the United States, between the states of Ohio and Illinois. Wallace had a lot of advantages growing up. His father at one time was the governor or leader of the state of Indiana. Lewis Wallace studied law as a young man, but his career got interrupted in 1846 when he decided to join the army and fight in what later became known as the Mexican-American War. He returned to his home a year later in 1847 when the war ended and finished his law studies. In 1849, he was admitted to the bar in Indiana and became a lawyer. The bar, B-A-R, is another word that we use for the legal profession, people who work as attorneys, as lawyers. In the United States, every state has its own bar association, which is a group that gives you an examination you have to pass in order to work as a lawyer in that state. Wallace also got married in this time period to a young woman, and together they had one son. Lew, as he was more commonly called, got interested in politics, as some lawyers do, unhappily, and became a member of the Indiana State Senate in 1856. The State Senate is part of what we call the legislature, which is one of the three main parts of a state government. It's also one of the three main parts of our national government. We have the executive branch, which in a state would be the governor. We have the legislative branch, which would be the legislature, the Senate, and the House of Representatives in most states. And we have the legal branch, which is the court system. Those are the three branches or parts of government in most states, in all states really, and in the United States national government. In any case, Wallace worked as a senator and as a lawyer, but he was interrupted once again a few years later in 1861 when, as you may know, the American Civil War began. The Civil War was a fight between the states in the northern part of the U.S. and the southern part of the U.S. The northern states were called the Union, and the southern states were referred to as the Confederacy. Wallace, living in a northern state, joined the Union Army. He did well in the Union Army, and within a few years, he was promoted or raised to one of the very highest levels in the Army, the rank of Major General. Your rank, R-A-N-K, is your position or role in the military. In the Army, for example, the lowest rank is a private. The highest rank is a general. Wallace became a general in the Army during the Civil War and fought in many important battles in the war. Immediately after the war, Wallace also served as part of a group of investigators who tried the people who were accused of assisting in the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln in 1865. To try, T-R-Y, here means to hear evidence in a courtroom to decide whether someone is guilty or not. There were eight people who were accused of helping with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. The eight men and one woman were tried and found guilty. Lewis Wallace was part of the nine-man military commission, or tribunal as it was called, that found them guilty. Interestingly enough, Wallace had agreed, just a few weeks after Lincoln's assassination, to become a military leader, a general, in Mexico. He had agreed to work for the then president of Mexico, Benito Juarez. In late 1865, he went to Mexico to work with the Mexican government. Remember that he had participated as part of the army fighting against Mexico just a few years earlier in the Mexican-American War. Wallace spent only a few years in Mexico before returning home and getting involved once again in politics. He didn't really like being a lawyer, which is why he wanted to get back involved in politics. He tried to become a member of the U.S. Congress, but he failed. Finally, in 1876, he helped Rutherford Hayes become the president of the U.S., and to thank him, he was given the job of being the new governor of the territory of New Mexico. A territory is part of a country that is not yet a state, in the case of the United States, or a province, as in the case of Canada. In the U.S., especially during the 19th century, there were several territories that were not yet made into states. Wallace's military experience helped him in New Mexico. Perhaps that was one reason he was given the job. At the time, many of the new white settlers coming into New Mexico were having problems with the Native Americans, who, of course, lived there already. A settler, S-E-T-T-L-E-R, is a person who moves to an area where there are few people living. The problem in New Mexico is that there were already people living there, and for some reason, I'm not sure why, they didn't particularly like these settlers coming in and taking their land. So there were problems, there were military conflicts with these settlers and the Native American people. As governor, Wallace was able to end the violence between the settlers. He, in part, also helped create a militia, M-I-L-I-T-I-A, which is basically a volunteer army that would help protect the settlers. Wallace, from the time he was a young boy, always loved to write, and he used some of his time in New Mexico to continue his writing career, which he had started a few years before this. He loved writing books, and in particular, historical fiction. Historical fiction are stories, novels, that are about real events in history, but include people and events that are fictional, that are made up, that are imaginary. His first historical novel was called The Fair God. It was published a few years before he became governor, in 1873. This novel was based in part on the story of the Spanish military when it first came to Mexico and took control of the country. But it was Wallace's second novel, written while he was the territorial governor of New Mexico, that made him the most famous popular novelist of the late 19th century, producing the most widely read book of his generation. That book was called Ben-Hur, H-U-R. Ben-Hur was published in 1880, and it told the story of the beginning of Christianity, of the life of Jesus Christ, but included some fictional characters, including Ben-Hur, the hero of the novel. In the book, a young Jewish man by the name of Judah Ben-Hur gets in trouble with the Roman army and is made a slave. Later, he and his family are converted to Christianity. The book has an obvious Christian theme. In fact, one writer said it was the most important Christian book of the late 19th century in America. Although now a famous novelist, Wallace continued to be involved in political life. In 1881, he was appointed the U.S. minister to Turkey. He was asked to represent or speak for the U.S. government in the country of Turkey. He stayed there until 1885. While he was there, he learned more about Turkish history, and he used that knowledge a few years later to write another historical novel, this time about the Byzantine Empire. It was called The Prince of India, and it was published in 1893. Wallace considered this novel, The Prince of India, or Why Constantinople Fell, to be his best novel, but it never had the success of Ben-Hur. Wallace wrote a few other things. He wrote a biography of President Benjamin Harrison and a long narrative poem. But his fame, the reason he was famous, was because of Ben-Hur. We turn now briefly to our second topic, the 1970s television show The Brady Bunch. The Brady Bunch was a popular TV show in the early 1970s. The name of the show refers to the family in the show. The last name of the family was Brady. And the fact that this was a large family. The word bunch, B-U-N-C-H, refers to a large group of things that are put together. One of the interesting things about the Brady Bunch TV series was it was one of the first TV series about a blended family in the United States. Blended, B-L-E-N-D-E-D, means mixing two things together. In this case, it was the story of a woman who had three daughters. There was a man who had three sons. Well, you can see where this is going. The man met the woman, and they became one big blended family. It's clear in the original show that the man in this family, Mr. Brady, Mike Brady, he was called, had lost his wife. His wife had died. The show does not tell us what happened to Carol's husband. Carol is the wife in the story. Originally, the idea was to say that the two of them had divorced, had ended their marriage. But the people who made the show didn't want to talk about divorce. It wasn't as common back in the late 60s and early 70s as it is now. So that was considered too controversial. So we are just never told what happened to Carol's husband. The first episodes for the show were aired or were on television beginning in 1969. The show was on television for 5 years until 1974. So it was when I was growing up as a young child. The first year of the show looked at the difficulties of these two families learning to live with each other as one family, and the rest of the 4 years of the show were about the children growing up, going through the sorts of things that children do as they grow up. The Brady Bunch was very popular with children and teenagers, including those in my household. The children in the story are different ages, so depending on how old you were while you watched the TV show, you felt you could relate to or feel connected to someone in the show. The show eventually was canceled in 1974. However, it continued to be shown for many, many years afterwards in what we would call reruns. A rerun, R-E-R-U-N, is an old television show that they keep showing on television, even though it's been, in many cases, 20, 30, even 50 years since the television show was first on. Because of these reruns, because the show continued to be on TV, even though there weren't any new episodes, people continued to like these characters. And in the late 1980s, they actually made a television movie called A Very Brady Christmas in 1988. It was, at the time, one of the most popular TV movies ever made. All of these people, like me, who grew up watching the Brady Bunch as children, wanted to see what happened to the children as they grew older. One of the things that most Americans will remember about Brady Bunch, indeed about many television shows from the 1970s, was the theme song. The theme, T-H-E-M-E song, is the song that is heard at the beginning of the show. Many theme songs during the 70s and 80s told the basic story or background of the show. So as you listen to the song, you actually learned a little something about the show itself. This was especially the case with the Brady Bunch. In fact, to this day, many people of my generation can probably sing you part of the Brady Bunch theme song because, well, we've heard it so many times. The song begins, "Here's a story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold like the mother, the youngest one in curls." So here's a story of a lovely, a beautiful lady who is bringing up three lovely girls. To bring, B-R-I-N-G, up, is a two-word phrasal verb meaning to raise, to take care of as children. All of them, meaning all of the girls, had hair of gold, that is, they were blonde, like their mother. Their mother had blonde hair. the youngest one, the youngest girl, was in curls, C-U-R-L-S. If you have curls in your hair, you have these round circles in your hair. Many women in particular, at one point anyway, in American fashion, like to put curls in their hair, and women still, of course, put curls in their hair. That's why we have things called curling irons, I-R-O-N-S. These are little sticks that get hot that you put in your hair in order to curl it, to create this circular effect. Some people like me growing up had curls in their hair without using curling irons. My hair was naturally curly, believe it or not. The song then continues. We find out about the woman, then we find out about the man. It's a story of a man named Brady who was busy with three boys of his own. They were four men living all together, yet they were all alone. So there was a man named Brady. He's the father, and he's busy with three boys of his own three children. They were four men. Of course, they weren't men. Three of them were boys, but we'll refer to them as men, living all together. They were all living in the same house, of course. Yet, they were all alone. Even though they were living together, they didn't have a mother, and that's why they felt alone. The father then had three sons, Greg, Peter, and Bobby, and the wife's three daughters were named Marcia, Jan, and Cindy. Then, at the end of this theme song, we hear what happened. Till the one day when the lady met this fellow, and they knew it was much more than a hunch, that this group must somehow form a family. That's the way we all became the Brady Bunch, the Brady Bunch, the Brady Bunch. That's the way we became the Brady Bunch. Bah! Till one day when the lady met this fellow, F-E-L-L-O-W. Fellow is another word for a gentleman, a man. And they knew that it was much more than a hunch, H-U-N-C-H. That sentence doesn't make all that much sense, but a hunch is a guess, something you think is true. The idea here, I believe, is that the man and woman, when they met each other, began to realize that they were going to form a family, that they were actually going to become a couple and have their children live together. And that's the way they became the Brady Bunch. Now let's answer some of the questions you have sent to us. The first question comes from Mare, M-E-R-V-E, in Turkey. The question has to do with three verbs, to prevent, to hinder, and to forbid. Let's start with the first verb, to prevent, P-R-E-V-E-N-T. To prevent someone from doing something means to stop someone before something is about to happen or that someone wants to happen. I'm preventing you from driving after you have been drinking by taking away your keys. I am stopping you from doing something that you want to do in this case. You could also prevent a fire in your house by making sure you don't leave the house with candles burning. What if there's an earthquake, as we have here in Los Angeles, and the candle falls on the ground? It could cause a fire. To prevent that, you would blow the candle out. You would make sure there wasn't any open flame before you left the house. That's preventing something from happening, doing something that will stop something from happening in the future. to hinder, H-I-N-D-E-R, means to make something difficult for someone or perhaps to slow down an action, but not to stop it. To hinder means to get in the way of someone doing something, to make it more difficult, but that doesn't mean you stop it completely. To forbid, F-O-R-B-I-D, is to order someone not to do something. To forbid is to give a rule or regulation or to have a law that says you can't do something. Just because you have a law that forbids you from smoking in your office, for example, doesn't mean that it will prevent someone from smoking in his office. You could still smoke even though the law forbids it. Preventing, hindering, and forbidding them are related, but they all have different meanings. To prevent is to stop something from happening. To hinder is to make it more difficult or to slow down a process. And to forbid means to say something shouldn't happen, to say you can't do something, even though someone may do it anyway. You will often see the past participle of to forbid, which is forbidden, F-O-R-B-I-D-D-E-N. You might see a sign that says, photography forbidden or not permitted. In other words, there's a rule that says you can't take photographs in that particular place. Our next question comes from Sung, S-U-N-G, in South Korea. The question has to do with two words, integral, I-N-T-E-G-R-A-L, and indispensable, I-N-D-I-S-P-E-N-S-A-B-L-E. Something that is integral is something that is part of something else, so much so that you can't separate it. It is part of what makes something complete. If some element is integral, if you remove it, you ruin or will do something that will destroy the thing that it was a part of before. In a car, for example, in an automobile, the engine, the motor, is integral. If you removed it, it's no longer a car because it can't move forward. We can also use this word integral in other senses, not just physically, but metaphorically. You could talk about the internet being integral to a democracy nowadays, that people need to be able to communicate with each other. It's become part of something else, so much so that if you remove it, that other thing is no longer complete. Indispensable means very important, very necessary. It's similar in meaning to integral. We would use indispensable especially in cases when we're talking about a certain function or activity. Our boss is indispensable for the success of this project. If she weren't here, the project would not be successful. It's usually used to describe a person or some characteristic that is necessary for something to be successful, to succeed. Integral is more related to how something is put together, whether it's a physical object or an organization. Indispensable can describe a quality or characteristic. Honesty is indispensable to a good judge. If you're not honest, you can't be a good judge or a good lawyer. So you could be a very rich lawyer and not be honest. That is possible. Finally, Modi, M-O-D-Y, in Egypt, wants to know the meaning of the expression to scare off. To scare, S-C-A-R-E, off, is a two-word phrasal verb meaning to cause someone to go away or stay away because that person is afraid. to create some sort of danger or to indicate that the other person might get hurt would be one way of scaring someone off. For example, if there's an animal that is approaching you, you might pick up a rock and throw it at the animal. That might scare off the animal. The animal might become afraid of you and then run the other direction. It's also possible that the animal could scare you off. You could start running in the other direction. That's what I would do. This phrasal verb appears in a sentence in The Hunger Games, the book, where one of the characters talks about scaring off game, G-A-M-E. The word game can mean some contest that you play, something you do for fun, like a game of cards or a game of Monopoly. But here it refers to animals, in particular to animals that are normally hunted. So if you are scaring off game, say in a forest or out in the country, you are making animals afraid so that they run away. If you have a question or comment, you can email us. Our email address is eslpod@eslpod.com. I promise I won't throw any rocks at you to scare you off. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thank you for listening. Come back and listen to us again right here on ESL Podcast.
ESL Podcast English Cafe was written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Singh.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by the Center for Educational Development.